it's a pleasure to see you all, the faithful few, holding out to the end of the conference. So thank you for coming today. Again, I'm Kimberly Ariola, and it's a pleasure to share some of the work that we've been conducting for the last couple of years with you this afternoon. I have no disclosures. I'd like to start just by acknowledging some really great collaborators, Dr. Jenny Perryman in the Emory Transplant Center. Dr. Nancy Thompson is a co-investigator and another professor in my department, and our project coordinator, Dr. Lamont Powell. We also have an audience, Lee McDonald, who also collaborated with us on this project, and another project coordinator that's really helped our thinking, Dana Robinson, in this project as well. So thanks for being here this afternoon. So this afternoon, what I'll do is talk a little bit about patient-level barriers to living donor transplant among African-American end-stage renal disease patients. I'll talk about Project Living Acts, which is a health education intervention that is designed to improve interest in living donor transplant among African-American patients. And I'll present some outcome findings that assess the extent to which Project Living Acts contributed to increased knowledge about the process, risks, and benefits of living donor transplant, as well as their willingness to discuss living donor transplant with family and friends, and their appreciation of the perceived benefit of living donor transplant. So let me just start by arguing the importance of transplant. Transplant has become the therapy of choice for many patients with end-stage organ failure. Transplant is necessary to save lives, improve quality of life, and extend life for individuals who are facing end-stage organ failure. In fact, improving access to transplant is one of the goals for Healthy People 2020. Reduce the amount of time spent on dialysis, particularly for patients with chronic kidney disease, by increasing their access to transplant. The problem is there is a large gap between the number of available organs and the number of transplants that are performed each year. So what the top line demonstrates is that over time, over almost the past 15 years, there's been a pretty dramatic increase in the number of individuals who are added to the national transplant waiting list. At the same time, what you see is a relatively flat line, the red line showing the number of transplants performed. It's gone up a little bit, but it's relatively flat, and a pretty flat line for the number of donors available. And so these flat lines and this increasing need has contributed to a widening gap between the number of available organs and those that are needed. And so when you also think about transplant, hopefully you're thinking about there being two sources of organs. There are organs from living donors and there are organs from deceased donors. And the evidence clearly suggests that organs from living donors offer medical benefit over a deceased donor organ. And so when you think about living donation, one of the advantages is that the transplant can actually be scheduled as opposed to having to occur at a moment's notice or, you know, with very short notice. The other advantage is that with living donor transplant, there's typically the possibility for better genetic matching because there's a greater opportunity for advanced testing with family or friends who agree to serve as a donor. Living donor transplant or organs from living donors tend to operate faster once they're transplanted. They tend to start operating quicker. Organs from deceased donors sometimes take several days to several weeks to begin functioning. And organs from living donors tend to last longer. They have a longer battery life, you could argue. They tend to last on average about 22 years versus 14 years from organs from deceased donors. So for these reasons, we tend to encourage living donor transplant to the extent that it's a viable option for a particular patient with end-stage organ failure, keeping in mind that certain organs are not amenable to living donor transplant, right? So heart, for example, wouldn't work, right? So deceased donor transplant is the only way a heart could be transplanted. But when you're thinking living donor transplant, at the minimum, you're thinking about things like kidneys, a kidney where a person could donate one kidney and continue living with the other. And so the kidney is particularly relevant to living donor transplant for this very reason. And this slide further argues the importance of living donor transplant in the case of kidneys. So what this chart illustrates is that patients who have living donor transplants, this is the first for the first transplant, they have a longer 10-year survival than patients who received a deceased donor kidney. They have a longer 5-year survival than patients who received a deceased donor kidney. Yet access to living donor kidney transplant is plagued with racial disparities. it's very clear that African Americans are overrepresented among those who need kidneys, and particularly in Georgia, and underrepresented among those who are receiving live donor kidney transplants. So in Georgia, where I'm based, African Americans make up about a third of the population, but 64%, almost two-thirds, of Georgia's kidney candidates. And in fact, at Emory, at the transplant center I collaborate with, 97% of the African American patients on Emory's waiting list are waiting for a kidney. The other 3% are waiting for all other organs. So the need for kidneys are great among African Americans in Georgia. The number of available kidneys is far less than the need. And so improving access to kidney transplant is particularly important for African Americans. This chart further argues that when you're looking at the percentage of blacks and whites on dialysis and on transplant, what you see here, if you focus on the live donor kidney transplant, those bars, you see that African Americans are much lower than whites in terms of being a recipient of a live donor kidney, whereas I've just argued the therapeutic benefit. And that was nationally, and in Georgia, it's equally as bad. What you see here in Georgia is African Americans the proportion of African Americans actually exceeds whites for deceased donor and in terms of being on the waiting list and in terms of receiving a kidney, but when it comes to live donor kidney transplant, African Americans are receiving a much smaller proportion. And so we think about this issue of supply and demand when we're talking about organ and tissue donation, right? So you could say, well, so what are the issues that either contribute to a patient getting an organ or not getting an organ? And we sometimes think about this as supply and demand. And so you could look on the supply side and say, okay, well, there's these factors that contribute to the availability of organs or increase the supply of organs. So that's people joining their state donor registry. That's one way to increase the supply of organs. And so we've actually been federally funded for about the last 10 years to improve African American commitment to the state donor registry. So that's the top right box. You could think about family dynamics and system level factors that increase the supply. But what I'm really talking about today is more on the demand side of things, okay? So you can think about patient level factors. To what extent is a patient with end-stage renal disease, you know, perfectly willing to stay on dialysis versus willing to explore transplant as a treatment option? And so you want to think about ways that you can increase interest in transplant among patients in order to increase the demand because of the therapeutic benefit of transplant in general, particularly live donor kidney transplant. But there are also physician-level factors and system-level factors that I'm not talking about today, but I do want to just kind of highlight this idea that individual-level interventions, I think, fit very nicely in the context of physician and system-level interventions as well, but individual-level interventions alone are not the end-all be-all, right? So we have to be clear about how our work kind of fits within these larger systems-level factors, within these larger factors. And so I think that in order to really increase demand, you've got to deal with all of these factors on the left-hand side, and the intervention I'm talking about today focuses on the upper left-hand side. So ideally, a successful intervention focusing on the patient-level factors, so African-American patients with end-stage renal disease, they would spur interest in living donor transplant as a treatment option, help patients share information about living donor transplant, and help them to be more open and accepting. The literature suggests that African-Americans, more than other groups, are more likely to not want to discuss living donor transplant with friends and family. They're more likely to not accept an organ from a family member who offers. And so just initiating that having that conversation is a very kind of important starting point for intervention. The other thing to keep in mind here is that it's not our goal to make every African-American ESRD patient have a live donor kidney transplant. It's not for everybody. What I think is important is that patients make informed decisions, and that when people decide, this is the other part of the slide I was just talking about, when people decide that that's a treatment option that they're interested in pursuing, that there are not physician-level and system-level barriers that impede that decision. So this is also not about kind of raising a patient's hopes when the physician-level and system-level factors are, you know, working against them, but you know, educating patients in the context of supports that occur at the physician and system level is what we hope to be doing. So we were funded by HRSA to implement Project Living ACTS, which is an acronym for about choices in transplantation and sharing. Our aims were to explore existing knowledge, willingness to share information, and perception of the benefits of living donor transplant, develop an intervention to improve these factors, and evaluate the efficacy of this intervention. So our intervention was largely driven by two major theoretical models. One is the IMB model, or the Information Motivational Behavioral Skills model, where our goal really was to help people to develop greater knowledge about living donor transplant, sharing information about living donor transplant, motivate them to share information, evaluate their confidence in their ability to actually share information in efforts to actually initiate discussion about living donor transplant. Our work is also formed by a colleague of mine, Ken Resnikow. He and a colleague developed the two-dimensional model of cultural sensitivity, where there are actually kind of two major components of cultural sensitivity. One is surface structure, where you might think of more kind of observable or superficial factors that are characteristics of an intervention. This might be, in our case, having African-American pictures or, you know, African-American subjects in the video. Whereas Resnikow and Argue have argued that many interventions in public health achieve this surface level, this surface structure level of cultural sensitivity, but really miss out on the deep structure level of cultural sensitivity. And so what I'm talking about now is really appealing to kind of the core cultural values of a particular cultural group. So our work in donation has historically focused on religious factors that serve as impediments to interest in donation. It's focused on some of the issues of distrust of the transplant system, the allocation system, the healthcare system more generally. In the case of the living donation of this particular intervention, we were really interested in dealing with some of the financial concerns that patients express. Kind of this idea that as a Black patient, something like a transplant would be out of the realm, out of the scope of possibility for me because of financial reasons. And so really kind of trying to address some of those financial concerns head on. Some participants really raised concerns about owing something to the living donor. One participant in some of our qualitative work said, it's not like you're borrowing $20. I mean, this is a major, you know, so this idea of asking for something that is so personal, something that's so deeply personal. And participants use language like, I don't want to go out begging for an organ. So, you know, it comes to how do you develop an intervention that deals with some of these cultural issues in ways that are salient to our particular population. And that's what we sought to do through our qualitative work that we conducted in the first phase of our study. Voila, the first phase. Right, so we did focus groups with individuals who are on the waiting list to receive an organ, with recipients of deceased organs from deceased donors, recipients from living donors, from individuals who have not decided to pursue transplantation at all just yet, so they're on dialysis, to try to understand what people think and feel about living donor transplant and transplant in general. We use this information to modify our existing intervention, and we basically made some modifications that allowed it to focus on living donor transplant, whereas our previous intervention materials, our federally funded interventions, tended to focus on donation. And then we evaluated the efficacy of this intervention. So these are just a few live still shots from the video where we had physicians talking about the process, risks and benefits of living donor transplant. We had brother pairs, sister pairs, coworkers talking about their decisions. And we hypothesized that individuals, we conducted a randomized trial, and hypothesized that individuals who received our intervention would have greater knowledge of the opportunities, process, risks, and benefits. They would have greater willingness to talk to family and a greater perception of the benefits than individuals in the control group. So participants underwent a baseline assessment while they were undergoing evaluation in the Emory Transplant Center. And they completed an immediate follow-up assessment. And then there was a 6-month telephone interview in which we asked them basically the same questions over the telephone. Our key measures are condition, intervention versus control, time, baseline, immediate, and 6-month follow-up, and then the condition by time interaction. And so what we found, in terms of participant characteristics. So there were 298 participants enrolled in our study. We achieved 90% retention and retained 268 participants in the study. We found that they ranged in age from 20 to 76 years. The mean was 62. They tended to be male and unmarried. They tended to be at least high school graduates and unemployed. And 57% had been on dialysis for 2 years or less. what we found is that our intervention was successful at increasing knowledge of living donor transplant as a viable treatment option, as evidenced by the significant condition by time interaction. We also found that in terms of willingness to talk to family, there was no effect of condition by time, but there was a condition effect. So what you see here with that top blue line is individuals who received living acts, that's the LA, at all time points were significantly higher in their willingness to talk about live donor transplant. And then finally, in terms of perceived benefits, what you see is that the living acts participants at immediate follow-up were scored significantly higher on perceived benefits, but that at 6 months, this effect had been attenuated. So if I were just to summarize our results, I would argue that knowledge significantly improved and was maintained at 6 months. Willingness to talk to family about live donor transplant did not increase due to our intervention, as evidenced by the baseline, the differences that existed at baseline, and that perceptions of benefits of living donor transplant improved at immediate but declined to baseline levels at 6 months. This is probably the most interesting finding, because by the six-month time point, participants actually had time to talk to their family. And what you think about is maybe in some cases those conversations were great, maybe in some conversations they were bad, and maybe after having some positive and some negative experiences, after having kind of been out in the world for those 6 months, their perceptions of the benefit of living donor transplant could have changed after 6 months. And the data suggests that, because our intervention did increase it at immediate follow-up. So clearly, one major limitation is the lack of an objective outcome. Whether Living Acts was associated with actual potential donor cards is something we're very interested in. Our funder just isn't. And so we were explicitly prohibited by our funder to study whether our intervention actually increased individuals' pursuit of living donor transplant. And I could talk to people after the session for those who want to talk more about that. We had a convenient sample, although our acceptance rate was really high. There were only a handful of people who declined participation in our study. People generally enjoyed the opportunity to talk and make a little bit of money in between all of those appointments during their evaluation. Data collected at various points throughout the evaluation. We started at the beginning in terms of baseline, showing the video and immediate follow-up. But then if an appointment needed to occur, we had to stop what we were doing. But you would expect that that happened equally across intervention and control groups. And so there was probably no effect on a particular condition. So in conclusion, I think that this idea of in-center, so within a transplant center, exposing individuals to information about the value of living donor transplant is potentially a really viable approach to health education. I think that our intervention has demonstrated success in terms of increasing knowledge, which is one of the main outcomes our funder was interested in. But I think that this idea of increasing willingness to talk to family really needs greater focus on how to initiate the conversation in a manner that people don't feel like they're begging for an organ. I think that efforts should be made to maintain the increased perceptions of benefits of living donor transplant. That's it. Thank you very much.